Well, it was working earlier. Ah, there we go. Well, good evening, everyone. This is a topic that I have long been passionate about, and I've believed that it's a really important topic for the church, because what's been happening is we are people who are followers of Jesus, and we have values of justice and inequality. We know that we're not supposed to be respecters of persons the way that Jesus taught us, and so it really goes. It's an issue that goes to the core of who we are called to be as followers of Jesus, and this whole topic of social justice has really been evolving over the past 20 to 40 years, and it has gotten worse and worse in its epistemology, its understanding of truth, in its worldview, and just a lot of really concerning things. And I saw it coming into the church in a heavily edited form that was very aware of what our beliefs as followers of Jesus are, and it's been presented in a very partial way that avoids raising some red flags for us that really should be raised. And so it's something that I've been very concerned about, but I've just kind of been nibbling around the edges for years because it's such a huge topic. And my nature is to be really comprehensive when I look at something, and also to be fair, try to be fair and balanced. And often the critiques that I read were from a right-wing political perspective, and, you know, they were 80% on target, but they clearly weren't from the perspective of a Jesus follower, and it clearly wasn't from the perspective of someone who takes the Sermon on the Mount seriously, and just some things like that. And I never really could get my mind around the whole issue comprehensively, but there were definitely issues. And that is until I found this book. And tonight is going to be, honestly, in many ways, a book overview of this book. It is Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth by Thaddeus J. Williams. And he does such a good job of compiling the data. It was a huge project that I didn't have energy for. And so I was just delighted to find someone from a very Jesus-honoring perspective tackling this issue, gathering the evidence, and presenting it from a very Christian worldview, as best I can interpret, from a very Christian worldview. And he is a lot more gracious and kind and generous in his interpretations of some things than I am. And so that was really good for me. And I feel like this is a book that fits very well with the spirit of Center. And I would highly encourage you guys to read this. Obviously, we can't come close to covering everything in this book tonight. I was asked to give a talk on biblical justice at a sword and trumpet colloquy or conference on critical race theory. And so about 10 or 15 minutes of tonight will be sort of a condensed version of looking at what is biblical justice. And in preparation for that, that was a life-changing study for me in how I viewed biblical justice. And in the process, there's three kinds of justice that really came to the fore. There's our Western idea of justice, and that is just, that is so, it's such an American value that it infiltrates how we think about God's justice, and it twists a little bit how we think about God's justice. So I'd like you to look at these three versions of justice and just keep them in the back of your mind as we go through tonight. And toward the end, we're going to look at some of the differences and what the Bible actually says, what is actual biblical justice. And in the process of that study, so we have our American-style justice system, and that's almost an idol for us. It's such a value. It's such a core value of Western thought, equal treatment under the law. And then under biblical justice, there's actually two words that the Bible uses that is translated justice. And one basically means more our Western idea of like justice, judgment, the final judgment, that sort of thing. And then the other one is actually better translated righteousness, but it is often translated justice. So we'll look at that. And then, of course, there's the popular social justice viewpoint, which we'll explore tonight. This is an overview of where we're going tonight. Hopefully, we'll be able to divide our time well. That is one of my primary concerns tonight, that we spend time on the things that we should spend time on. I will be doing a lot of reading because, like I said, the way that Thaddeus summarizes things is just really gets the heart of the issue. So one thing that Thaddeus does, so we're going to start off with definitions. And so the first thing, Thaddeus talks about social justice A and social justice B. Like I said, he's a little more generous than I am. I'm not sure that social justice as a term can be salvaged because of all the modern meaning that is in that word. I like the dictionary meaning. I like the dictionary meaning. I think there should be justice in our social system. And I mean, who doesn't want justice? We all want justice, right? But it has come to mean a lot more than that simple meaning. So Thaddeus talks about social justice A, which is a sort of a godly perspective on social justice. And then he talks about social justice B, which is what I would say 80% of the U.S. would think of when they hear the term social justice. We had the word gay redefined, and I don't fight against that. I don't like redefinitions of words, but I don't fight against that definition. I don't go around encouraging people to be happy and gay, going back to the original original meaning of the word. And so as little as I like redefinitions, I do think that there's times, one of the main reasons that redefinitions aren't good is because they are confusing. And any time that we are being confusing, it's an impediment to truth. One of the main reasons that I don't think that I can use the term social justice myself is the concept of intersectionality. And so social justice B would say that these are all issues of social justice, eradicating racism, economic fairness, and those are both things that I can get behind, in the social justice realm. But then there's also Marxism and socialism, radical feminism, destruction of gender distinctions, sexual freedom, homosexuality and gay marriage, transgender and queer ideology. And this is a definition of intersectionality from the Center for Intersectional Justice. It's the first result on Google, and I assume they're an authoritative source. It very much lines up with my understanding. And it basically, it gives the idea that the fight for social justice includes all of these things. And I didn't include any quotes here, but there are a number of quotes from feminists, especially black feminists, who are very angry at white feminists for not joining in the fight for not just feminism, but also in racial justice and in justice for transgender folks and justice for homosexual rights and all those sorts of things. And so there's a very strong belief within the social justice movement that all of these are part and parcel of the same thing. And so that's one reason that I don't, I just feel like the things that I don't agree with outweigh the things I do. And to me, if I would say I'm in favor of social justice, it'd be a bit like saying I'm in favor of Buddhism just because I believe that you should suppress desire, sinful desires especially, and be disciplined, live a disciplined life. Well, yeah, that's a small part of Buddhism, but that doesn't make me a Buddhist. And so while we share some of the same goals, to me there's just so much with it. And I'll stop talking and we'll just keep going rather than spending time with my the way that I defined it. I would just like to get straight to the direct sources on some of the problems. So redefinitions is a big thing in social justice. Just a quote here, a really good quote from George Orwell, 1984. "It's a beautiful thing, the destruction of words. The ministry of peace concerns itself with war, the ministry of truth with lies, the ministry of love with torture, and the ministry of plenty with starvation. These contradictions are not accidental, nor do they result from ordinary hypocrisy. They are deliberate exercises in doublethink. Don't you see that the whole aim of Newspeak is to narrow the range of thought? In the end, we shall make thought crime literally impossible, because there will be no words in which to express it. Every concept that can ever be needed will be expressed by exactly one word." And I'm just going to skip down. And in the end, there won't be any need for even that. The revolution will be complete when the language is perfect. So we're already familiar with some redefinitions of words. Murder of babies is pro-choice, and obviously free will and choice are good values. Homosexual sin that destroys people's lives has been redefined as gay and happy, and of course the rainbow has been appropriated, which is a promise of God. And tolerance has moved from tolerating someone with a different viewpoint to actually agreeing with them. I am intolerant of someone if I don't agree with their perspective. And of course, that redefinition is internally inconsistent, because if I disagree here with somebody and I say, I really think McDonald's hamburgers are best, and you're like, no, definitely Burger King, and I can tolerate your opinion and not beat you up because we have different opinions, but if I actually agree with you and say, yeah, Burger King is best, I no longer have any need of tolerating. I mean, it's an opinion I agree with. And so it's a radical shift there in the concept of tolerance from tolerating someone with a different viewpoint to actually agreeing with them. The two key words that have been redefined most recently, and you may not, it really is confusing. And racism is the big one. Racism has been redefined from the classic idea of discriminating against someone because of their skin color. It has changed to racism plus power. So the idea is that, leading social justice advocates have said this straight out, a black person cannot be racist because they are not the predominant power here in the U.S. White people are the predominant power in the U.S., and so it has to be racism plus power, or discrimination plus power is how they would term it, because they've changed the meaning of racism. And of course, this leads to some really weird conclusions that I listed here, and that is that when Hitler was powerless in the prison cell before he became leader of Germany writing Mein Kampf, he wasn't racist because he was a prisoner. And did the Nazis become less racist with every Allied victory? Did Barack Obama being president automatically reduce racism? And of course, black folks do have enormous power and privilege in our society in shaping our culture and so forth. The other word that has been redefined is whiteness, and we will talk about that more in a later section. So moving on to the foundations of racism, tribalism is a word I'm sure you've heard quite often. Now, being part of a tribe is not a bad thing. It's actually a very good thing. American culture is that of rugged individualism, and the Western pioneer spirit, and the Bible actually calls us to community and to interdependence. And there's a Harvard researcher, Robert Putnam, found that if you belong to no groups but decide to join one, you cut your risk of dying the next year in half. And that people with unhealthy habits like smoking, poor diet, heavy drinking, outlive disconnected people. So being connected to a tribe is very important. The problem lies in often when we are connected to a tribe, tribes like to make war on each other. And they like to feel, you know, they tend to get into the us versus them problem, sort of situation. And so talking about tribalism, it inspired the lynching trees of America, the smokestacks of Auschwitz, the gulags of Siberia, the killing fields of Khmer Rouge, and the butchery of those in Rwanda, Darfur, Congo, and more. Given its bloody track record, you would think the idea would be universally rejected. But is staging a massive comeback in the 21st century, rebranding itself as justice. What is this bad idea? Tribalism is the idea that we should divide people into group identities, then assign undesirable or evil traits to that group in such a way that we don't see the unique image bearers of God before us. As Shelby Steele points out, collective identities tend to reduce individual human beings to non-individuated members of a particular group or class. As an ex-social justice B devotee put it, I did not engage with individuals as individuals, but as porcelain, always thinking first and foremost of the group identities we inhabited. And of course, over history, we've seen this in action. We are Aryan, we are Nazis, we are good, they're Jewish, they're bad. We're Brahmin, we're good, they're untouchables, they're bad. We're Hutu, they're Tutsi, the Rwandan genocide. We're white, they're black. We're the Islamic State, we're good, they're the infidels. And of course, the examples go on and on. Another key thing of racism is propaganda and having alternative history. What would it take to totally invert the second great commandment, to love our neighbors as ourselves and rally neighbors to turn on one another in bloodthirsty rage? The answer is, in a word, propaganda. An old Nazi pamphlet says that the Jew only looks human with a human face, but his spirit is lower than that of an animal. He represents unparalleled evil, a monster, subhuman. The Tutsis of Rwanda were called cockroaches. KKK literature reduced blacks to gorillas. I've spent hundreds of hours reading through propaganda and found three common marks. Propaganda is highly edited history. It encourages us to treat individual neighbors as exemplars of their group, and it gives us a way to blame all of life's troubles on that group. Just like other propaganda throughout history, Social Justice B edits history in the most damning way possible against people groups. And so I'd like to read from Thomas Sowell's History of Slavery that gives a very different perspective from that of social justice. Thomas Sowell is an African-American author and scholar who has done some really good work on the issue. Slavs, who are an Eastern European, white Eastern European group, Slavs were so widely used as slaves in both Europe and the Islamic world that the very word slave derived from the word for Slav, not only in English, but also in other European languages, as well as in Arabic. While slavery was common to all civilizations, only one civilization developed moral revulsion against it very late in its history, Western civilization. Themselves the leading slave traders of the 18th century, Europeans became in the 19th century the destroyers of slavery around the world. The British stamped out slavery not only through the British Empire, but also in Brazil, Sudan, Zanzibar, the Ottoman Empire, and Western Africa, often at great loss of British lives and money. Americans stamped it out in America, in the Philippines. The Dutch stamped it out in Indonesia, the Russians in Central Asia, the French in their West African and Caribbean colonies. The Westerners who stamped out slavery did so over the bitter opposition of Africans, Arabs, Asians, and others. On the issue of slavery, it was essentially Western civilization against the world. Moreover, within Western civilization, the principal impetus for the abolition of slavery came first from very conservative religious activists, people who would today be considered the religious right. Clearly, this story is not politically correct in today's terms, hence it is ignored as if it never happened. But even if we would, if we leave the history aside, because there's always arguments about history, and there's always spin, and there's always bias, and we have the thing of, you know, the victors write history. Even if we lay all that aside, we come back to the principle that even if other white people did terrible things, and they did terrible, terrible things in slavery, from a Jesus worldview, from a non-racist worldview, just because I'm white and I do something bad doesn't mean that Nate has responsibility for it. My skin color being the same as Nate has nothing to do, that gives me no moral linkage with him. So even if other white people did evil things, it doesn't somehow make me responsible and guilty. If another black person commits a crime, it doesn't, I had this lovely elderly black lady neighbor, and you know, the classic white supremacist thing is, you know, crime is higher among black people, and you know, they're all just a bunch of criminals, and you know, there's all sorts of nasty things and generalizations that white supremacists make. And but living next to someone like her, it's obviously ridiculous that I would generalize what the actions of a few people with that skin color to her and to many others like her who don't have anything to do with crime. Most black folks and most white folks aren't criminals. And that kind of a generalization is the classic definition of racism. And so the idea that the history of slavery somehow, because they shared my skin color, that I somehow have a moral linkage to that is just as bad of an idea and just as racist of an idea as, you know, my black neighbor having responsibility for, you know, some black folks who commit crimes in Hutch or something like that. And of course, to me the classic definition of that classic kind of racism is put in a positive form by Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. And he said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." And to me, this is both his definition, it's also a very biblical definition of how we are called to relate to people, not on the basis of skin color. Skin color has no moral value one way or the other. And we'll look later at some of the scriptures that talk about that. So now we're getting into the section. I strongly believe that right-wing racism, which is very talked about in the U.S. under the banner of white supremacy, and left-wing, and the extreme left-wing approach to race, in the whole, you know, social justice and critical race theories, is also very racist, and they're just mirror images of each other. And so I'd just like to compare and contrast some statements from some of those folks. So starting off with the right wing, after a terrorist attack by Muslims, Trump called for the total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what's going on. Our clear goal must be the advancement of the white race and separation of the white and black races. This goal, and now this is David Duke, a grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan at the time. Separation of the white and black races. This goal must include freeing of the American media and government from subservient Jewish interests. Laziness is a trait in blacks. It really is. I believe that, said Donald Trump. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with them. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. And David Duke then said, more than, in echoing a lot of that, though David Duke said it first, more than 95% of both legal and illegal immigration in the United States is non-white. Because of the way immigration law is structured, the highest skilled nations on earth, those of Europe, are allowed only a tiny percentage of immigrants, while the third world nations, such as Mexico, are dumping their chaff onto American shores at the highest rate in history. We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. You wouldn't believe how bad those people are. These aren't people, these are animals. So it's very much along the same lines of the demonizing people and making them sort of subhuman, so that we can treat them in ways that are bad. And it's that whole tribalism thing. Moving on to the left, Ikemeni Uwan is described by Christianity Today as a public theologian and writer who has dedicated her life to combating racism and bringing awareness to the issues of colorism, microaggressions, and white supremacy. The bio on her own website describes herself further as one who is passionate about theology. Ikemeni has a fierce commitment to the gospel and its implications for issues pertaining to racial injustice, anti-black racism, and white supremacy. Ikemeni believes that theology can and does speak to our present day's culture, social, and political issues. And here is a quote of hers where she was addressing a Christian conference on peacemakers. And this is her approach to peacemaking, and this is her definition of the idea of whiteness. And this is not a cherry-picked example. It's very much what the mainstream definition of whiteness is. When we talk about white identity, then we have to talk about what whiteness is. Well, the reality is that whiteness is rooted in plunder, in theft, in slavery, in enslavement of Africans, genocide of Native Americans. It's a power structure. That is what whiteness is. Because you have to understand something. Whiteness is wicked. It is wicked. It's rooted in violence. It's rooted in theft. It's rooted in plunder. It's rooted in power and privilege. And so this is the... whiteness is a very common concept and a prominent concept in social justice theory and critical race theory. And the attempt is to say whiteness are all the bad parts of white culture. So they're trying to, in an effort to maintain plausible deniability on racism, they say, well, these are just the bad parts of white culture. They're not the good parts, it's just the bad parts. And so it's a total redefinition of just like the basic meaning of the word, because when you or I hear whiteness, we're like, well, that means what it means to be white, right? And a simple way that we can understand how racist of a term this is by just turning it around and saying, okay, well, what is blackness? If we say blackness is all the worst parts of black culture and none of the good parts, and we start trumpeting that definition, then we would be rightly, I would get on your case if you tried to do that, because that's wrong. It's generalizing the bad attributes, and it's very clearly, we could, you know, David Duke and Ikemeni Uwan here could talk all they wanted about saying, oh, well, it's not actually to do with the color of your skin, it's just the bad parts of your culture. Well, they can talk all they want about that, and they can try to spin that, but it's really obviously making that association in our heads so that we have a negative reaction to white people or a negative reaction to black people. And so to me, that's just one of the most blatant examples of racism in the social justice movement. The next essay we'd like to look at is called Killing Rage by Bell Hooks is her name, and That's her pen name. And as I was doing research for this, I was looking for quotes on white supremacy, or I was actually looking for quotes by white supremacists for that previous section of David Duke and Trump and so forth. And there was a Goodreads page that came up, and it was quotes about white supremacy. And this Gloria Watkins or Bell Hooks was probably 20% of the quotes. She's extremely, extremely prominent, and she is required reading in many sociology courses, many racial studies courses. And she was a professor at Yale and now at City College in New York. And the situation was. She was on an airplane, and she is a black woman, and she sat down in first class, and her friend, who was also a black woman, sat down beside her, and after they sat down, the lady beside her, who she calls Kay, got paged over the intercom and said, "Hey, Kay, can you come up to the front? We need to verify something with your boarding pass." And so she went up, and they said, "We're so sorry. We accidentally upgraded you, and we shouldn't have. And there's actually a paying customer that needed to that had that seat, and so you actually have to go back to coach now." And I've personally seen this happen many times. Obviously mostly white people. But this was Gloria Watkins' response to that. And actually, I'm going to start by reading Thaddeus's description of the essay. In a killing rage, she begins with the line, "I'm writing this essay beside an anonymous white male that I long to murder. The impetus for this murderous rage was a seating mix-up on a commercial flight. Hooks takes her first-class seat beside a friend she simply identifies as Kay. And I'll skip down. An anonymous white male with a first-class ticket replaces Kay. He apologizes for the inconvenience. He apologizes for the inconvenience. And here is what Bell Hooks has to say. I stare him down with rage, tell him I do not want to hear his liberal apologies, his repeated insistence that it was not his fault. I'm shouting at him that it's not a question of blame, that the mistake was understandable, but that the way Kay was treated was completely unacceptable, that it reflected both racism and sexism. I let him know he had an opportunity to not be complicit with the racism and sexism that is so all-pervasive in this society. I felt a killing rage. I wanted to stab him softly, to shoot him with the gun I wished I had in my purse. And as I watched his pain, I would say to him tenderly, racism hurts. As though I were the black nightmare that haunted his dreams, he seemed to be waiting for me to strike, to be the fulfillment of his racist imagination. I leaned toward him with my legal pad, made sure he saw the title written in bold print, Killing Rage." And obviously this illustrates that all of these beliefs about racism can lead to violence, and they often sort of trend that way. But what's more important, I think, here is actually her uncritical assumption that there is systemic racism and systemic sexism. And her assumption was that it wasn't a random mix-up where the agents had no idea of the race of the people, but that it was motivated somehow. And she actually kind of hints that she knows that it wasn't actual racism or sexism, but that because it was, because of the situation, because of how oppressed she is, he should have, as a generous gesture, he should have given her his seat, and he should have gone back to coach because of how it was just insult on injury that they experienced throughout their lives, and we'll get more into that here in a little bit. Two more examples, and I'm not gonna. Well, I will read one comparison here. These are two recent articles that appeared in the New York Times and Washington Post, and "Can My Children Be Friends with White People?" The answer, he muses about it, and he doesn't think, if you're one of the 50% that voted for Trump, definitely no. And you know, if you're an ally and a protester, then maybe. And then "Why Can't We Hate Men?" is a feminist writing, of course, and we're going to look at that a little bit, we're going to compare it to an article written in Wake Up, which is the largest newspaper in Rwanda before the genocide, and just compare some of the parallels between that kind of that kind of language. So starting with "Why Can't We Hate Men?" "Here in the land of legislatively legitimated toxic masculinity, is it really so illogical to hate men? But we're not supposed to hate them because hashtag not all men. But when they have gone low for all of human history, maybe it's time for us to go all Thelma and Louise and Foxy Brown on their collective butts." Now, I had to Google that, both of those references, as I was totally unfamiliar. But apparently Thelma and Louise shot and killed somebody that was trying to rape them in a movie in the 90s. And Foxy Brown is a rather violent African-American rapper who's been to jail a few times. So some sort of violence is being threatened there, obviously. Every Hutu should know that every Tutsi is dishonest in business. His only priority is the supremacy of his ethnic group. The experience of the October War has taught us a lesson. The Hutus must be firm and vigilant against their common Tutsi enemy. Men should pledge to vote for feminist women only. Don't run for office. Don't be in charge of anything. Step away from the power. We got this. All strategic positions, political, administrative, economic, military, and security should be entrusted only to Hutu. The education sector, schools, pupils, students, teachers must be majority Hutu. Growing movements challenge masculinity, build on domination and violence, and to engage boys and men in feminism are both gratifying and necessary. Please continue. Hutu ideology must be taught at every level to every Hutu. Every Hutu must spread this ideology widely. And please know that your crocodile tears won't be wiped away by us anymore. You have done us wrong. Hashtag because patriarchy. The Hutu should stop having mercy on the Tutsi. It is long past time to play hard for team feminism and win. The Hutu must be firm and vigilant against their common enemy, the Tutsi. Okay, moving on, we need to keep moving. Social justice versus reality. There's a strong strain of anti-rationalism in the modern social justice movement. And as a white person, I am not, in their belief system, I am not able to validly question any of this or have any conversations about this, really, because I'm white, and it's outside of my lived experience. And, of course, that's the basic logical fallacy of ad hominem instead of addressing the actual issue. A white scholar questions the social justice B narrative of vast systemic racism. She is seen as proving her own racism, and I'm reading here from the book, proving her own racism, protecting her privilege or complicity in white supremacy. If she uses logic and evidence, then she is using constructs like logic and evidence to oppress or erase people of color. And there's a strong movement that science and logic and so forth are tools of white supremacy or Western constructs designed to oppress black people. 60 years ago, under the sway of modernism, ideas were typically criticized as if they lacked evidence. And we are now in the post-postmodern era, where it's not even tolerance that is the goal, but it's actually identity. If you're not a woman, if you're not a minority, then you simply cannot. You're not supposed to speak to these issues. Keeping on moving. So systemic racism believes, here in the words of Ibrahim X. Kendi, racial disparities must be the result of racial discrimination. When I see racial disparities, I see racism. So the basic idea of systemic racism, and there are systems of racism. There was American slavery, there was Jim Crow, there was the Nazis, there was redlining, in the 50s and 60s and maybe even 70s, where people were denied housing based on their race. Trump was sued for denying housing based on race. He marked all his applications that had black people on them with a big old C, and they would never get it. And they were told the apartments were empty. So there are systemic forms of racism, and there have been in the past 100 years. But when social justice talks about systemic racism, what they're actually talking about is a difference of outcome. It's not what we would logically think of as systemic racism, to where a whole system is actually working together to enforce a racist outcome. So one example is there was a big headline saying that the cops, the New Jersey cops, are racist because they stopped twice as many black drivers on the New Jersey Turnpike as white drivers. And of course, this was a big deal for a while. And then a public policy institute came along, and they used high-speed cameras, and they used radar guns, and they photographed 38,000 drivers on the New Jersey Turnpike and assigned their speed to each one. And they actually found that the black folks were speeding at twice the rate. There were twice as many black folks speeding as white folks, and so it was actually a difference of behavior. And what was even more interesting is it actually wasn't necessarily a cultural difference between blacks and whites, but it was rather a demographic difference. And there were the average age of the black person in that area was much younger than the average age of the white person. And across races, younger people speed more than older people. And so the difference was entirely one of age and sort of random statistical chance. And there was no indication that there was anything to do with racism once someone actually did the work, the hard work. And this is why it's so often not done, is because it takes a lot of work to actually control for the important relevant factors. Police shootings, there's really good work, I won't go into it, by Roland Fryer, who also controlled for the behavior of the people that police end up shooting. Really good work there. Reading from the book, age has a big impact on unequal outcomes. In the United States, for example, the median age of Japanese Americans is 51, the median age of Mexican Americans 27. And so obviously, they're just going to have very different outcomes because of age, where they're at in their careers, if we're comparing pay, compensation, just all that sorts of thing. There's geography. There's 22 of the 29 astronauts in the original Apollo space program were firstborns. People living in the U.S. experience 90% of the world's tornadoes. We probably experience even more of that and are even more oppressed by systemic tornado oppression here in Kansas. And Asians are underrepresented in the NBA, NFL, NHL, and MLB. Women are overrepresented in healthcare, in attaining university degrees. Men make up the overwhelming majority of soldiers who perish on battlefields, etc. Jews, making up less than 1% of the world's population, receive 22% of Nobel Prizes in chemistry, 32% in medicine, 32% in physics. Culture makes a huge difference. Demographics make a huge difference. Geography makes a huge difference. And there's so many things that affect outcomes. And when we have this idea that outcomes equal proof of racism, we go to really untruthful places. And there's just, you have to go in and control for that stuff. There is still some bad stuff that happens once you control for all that. There's concerning areas there, and I don't have time to focus on that tonight, but there are evidences of bias after controlling for all that. Unfortunately, that is not done nearly as often. Here's a bunch of ethnicities that earn more on average than white folks. Let's get to the Bible. There is neither Jew nor Gentile, slave nor free, male nor female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one. Actually, before, I'm just going to leave this up here. Y'all can be reading this if you would like. I did skip a section that we really should talk about because it's a really important point that is something that is close to my heart, because I feel like the social justice approach to racism really harms black people, and this is why. Social justice B thinking does the exact opposite of what good. Going back. Ponder how phobias work. The uh-oh center, the fear reflex, kicks in, and our logical thinking shuts down. The literature is clear. Exposure therapy has tremendous effects. So you expose yourself to what scares you, and you get over that that fear, that phobia. Good psychologists help phobics ungeneralize. Whether through exposure or cognitive therapy, good psychologists help people internalize that specific trauma, that specific trauma should not be generalized. Trauma from this spider does not mean all spiders are out to kill you. My wife would disagree. Trauma from this sickness does not mean that the whole microscopic world is plotting your death from every doorknob. Good psychologists rewire phobic brains to realize the world is not, in fact, as terrifying as their brains' uh-oh center would have them believe. Social justice B thinking does the exact opposite of what good psychologists do. It generalizes. That spider bit you. Listen to all these other stories of lethal spider bites. Here are some Facebook groups, podcasts, public protests, and college courses to remind you daily that the spiders, or rather the theocrats, racists, Islamophobes, bigots, exploiters, and sexists are out to get you. The brain's assessment center is bypassed. People questioning whether the spiders are out to get you are probably spiders themselves. The uh-oh center is ignited, and social justice B thinking allows for nothing that might stop the flames from spreading until the whole brain turns to ash. This is where lived experience comes in. If a little boy, call him Johnny, has been convinced that most, if not all, spiders are out to get him, then imagine what Johnny will experience the next time he spots a daddy long legs under his bed. He will experience fear from a spider that is clearly an existential threat. He really, truly feels that it is out to get him. Johnny's lived experience is his reality. The only problem is that Johnny's reality is not reality. Daddy long-legged spiders are harmless to humans. And there's a lot more that could be said there, but for lack of time, we're going to leave it there. He himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. All are justified freely by his grace through the redemption. We are all on level ground in front of the cross. It does not matter our skin color. Our skin color doesn't make us an oppressor. It doesn't make us a victim. We all have sinned. We're all in need of God's grace. And when we divide the world into oppressors and victims, we obscure this fact. Stop judging by mere appearances, but instead judge correctly. My brothers and sisters, believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ must not show favoritism. Okay, we need to talk about biblical justice versus Western justice. And we're going to not have much time to go on this, but the basic thing is that there are two words in the Old Testament, mishpat, and tzedakah, that are two very different words. And 21 of 28 times that the English word justice appears in the KJV, it is both justice and judgment. So they're very closely linked. This justice and this judgment is the way KJV puts it. ESV, NASB puts it righteousness and justice, which is how I prefer, after spending hours and hours digging into every possible use of it. And I think that conveys the sense the best based on the context. Often ancient words, we have some idea of their meaning, but it's really the context where we really learn what does this actually mean. And so after digging into that, justice and righteousness are the two meanings that I think are the best translations. And the really cool thing is we have the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. So we know what the people of Jesus' time, the words they associated, and it's a one-to-one relationship here, krisis and mishpat, justice, judgment, and then dikaisune, and I'm mispronouncing that, and tzedakah, which is righteousness. And so just... we, of course, all like everyday justice. This is my car in San Francisco after Benji and my laptops got smashed the window got smashed and stolen. We often hear the social justice people saying, you know, I don't know if you remember that verse at the very beginning, but it's seek justice, you know, protect the widow, and some things like that. And it very much has the idea of righteousness, like taking care of people, and it has much less the idea of a judgment, of a final judgment, of a Western-style justice that would arrest that person and put them in jail because they stole something. The idea of arresting someone, putting them in jail, is that one of judgment, most of the, I think like 70% of the time, 80% of the time that judgment is used in the New Testament, it is actually talking about the final judgment. And of course, in the Old Testament, judgment and justice was a very terrible thing. There was the death penalty for rebellion, for enslavement, for striking parents, cursing parents, being careless with the cows, and letting someone die. You know, there's just a lot of things that had the death penalty. And so I, you know, it's often used as a reason. Anyway, let's keep moving. Romans 3:23, we already talked about this. I just want to spend a little time on the concept of righteousness because I feel like this is what really separates our perspective from kind of the typical American Christian perspective. And I think it's really important to realize that when God is talking about justice, he's actually thinking about some things that are very different from just like a Western-style justice and punishment for sins. And he is talking about that at the final judgment. He is talking about that kind of justice. God is a God of justice, but he also calls us to righteousness. And to the sword and trumpet audience, I gave a lot of examples from Marietta and from my parents and from Rise Kids Church and all the sorts of things that Hands of Christ is doing as ways that this is being fulfilled by y'all. And I deeply appreciate that, and I think that's amazing, that's wonderful. And I think we as an American church need to focus on that kind of thing more. And so here are some things about righteousness in the Old Testament. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deed. Give justice to the weak and the fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. One gives freely, yet grows all the richer. Another withholds what he should give and only suffers want. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats bursting with wine. Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honors him. And these are clearly above and beyond what American Western justice is. There's a lot of scriptures here. The Old Testament talks a lot about this concept of righteousness. The New Testament is even more relevant for us, of course. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. Religion that is pure and undefiled. We know that verse. Invite people who can't invite you back. As for the rich, charge them not to be haughty, nor set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. He laid down his life for us. We ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. Generosity, righteousness. There is some justice that we should consider, and that is criminal justice reform. There's some very unequal ways of, and some counterproductive ways of meting out justice, and you know, some innocent people going to prison, and I think that is one of the few appropriate ways that we can pursue justice, is to advocate for those who cannot advocate for themselves. And I told the story of Marietta here, which I'm sure you guys probably already heard, in some testimonies of her advocating for someone in court who couldn't speak English, and just making sure some of that righteousness and fairness justice as well is covered. Then I also just showed this, Amos's transformation from a drug addict. You wouldn't see this 6 years ago, not that we didn't cross paths, but I would have cuffs on. Today we work together, have an interest in our recovery community and care. I'm so grateful today he wants to come to our group and be a support, not a threat. God is at work in our community, bringing us together. Revival is happening here. And this is the kind of thing that happens when we as a church are focused on righteousness and on giving righteousness, imparting righteousness to our community. So, in conclusion, the Bible is clear. There is real oppression in the world. And tonight I've been focused on the fake oppression, and I apologize for that in a way, but I feel Center in general is at a pretty good place in fighting some of the righteousness battles, fighting the oppression battles, and for us, I think we're tempted by some of this social justice that is presented in a deceitful way, and we need to understand what's the worldview behind some of this. So hopefully we will now recognize some of these terms. So like I said, in some ways I apologize for that, in other ways I don't. But here's just kind of a conclusion from Thaddeus, and it's my conclusion as well. The Bible is clear. There's real oppression in the world. There's a big difference between believing this truth and downloading social justice B thinking as our mental operating system. One helpful way to tell the difference is to honestly ask ourselves, how do we process evidence that oppression may not be the best explanation in this or that case? If we care about ending actual sexism, then we should welcome the question of how much of the gender pay gap can be laid at the feet of actual sexism. Otherwise, we aren't fighting the real problem, but shadowboxing our own ideological projections. The extent to which we do that is the extent to which we trivialize the victims of real sexism and real racism. By diverting our finite injustice-fighting energies in every direction all at once, this thinking intentionally marginalizes already marginalized. Calling most everything racism hurts the victims of actual racism. How shall we deal with those who are embracing aspects of social justice? Then, and Thaddeus gives this answer, then there are some Christians who embrace perhaps one or two of the social justice B doctrines mentioned. We must also be careful not to project the entire system onto our brothers and sisters. I am concerned about the worldview behind the system, and I think it all kind of fits together, but we need to make sure we're not, and I have a weakness in that. I assume that everyone knows all that worldview stuff and agrees with it, and that's a bad assumption. That would not be helpful. There is, however, a predictable pattern. One social justice B doctrine tends to lead to another, then another, until many Christians end up abandoning their faith. I have watched this play out more times than I care to recall. With love as our motive, rather than dominating a political battle, we must winsomely point out to fellow Christians how social justice B makes it much harder for us to live the scriptures together. And once again, I just confess that I have not done very well at this. This leaves us with one final question. How do we best engage those who have been swept into the flow of social justice B? We do so with the same tried and tested method the church has used for millennia. We preach the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. We herald the good news that only Jesus can define the ultimate meaning and aim in the deeply meaningful ways that we cannot. We offer the good news that we no longer have to pretend and force others to pretend that we are perfect. Jesus is perfect, and through his substitutionary death for our evil, he offers a new identity as infinitely beloved sons and daughters of God. We preach the good news of his bodily resurrection by which he launched the age to come with all its shalom and justice. We preach the same gospel that was able to bring real racial reconciliation to first century Jews and Gentiles and real liberation to the slaves of American and British history. We preach the only gospel that offers real meaning to our generation, created to know and enjoy God. To those gasping for air under the crushing weight of social B, we preach the gospel. But that is not all. If we don't want to see more of our brothers and sisters abandon the gospel for social justice B, then we must show them through our words and actions just how compelling, beautiful, and liberating social justice can be when we do it God's way, by his grace, through his power, for his glory, and for the good of his image bearers. We can't simply knock social justice B, then take a seat and fold our arms as if our work is done. We must take action and show our brothers and sisters, and indeed the watching world, what it means to truly execute justice. And I would add, execute righteousness. I leave you with the words of T.S. Eliot: the world is trying the experiment of attempting to form a civilized but non-Christian mentality. The experiment will fail, but we must be very patient in awaiting its collapse, meanwhile redeeming the time so that the faith may be preserved alive through the dark ages before us, to renew and rebuild civilization and save the world from suicide. Let's end with a word of prayer. Dear Father, thank you so much for your incredible love for us. Thank you that we are created in your image and that we can derive our identity as children of yours. Thank you that you have given us a beautiful diversity of people all around us, and I pray that we would embrace every one from different backgrounds and show them true righteousness, true love, true care, and defend those who are defenseless, and just show us how to build your kingdom here in Hutch and wherever we may be from, to reflect your values, who love the downtrodden, love the poor, love the oppressed, and you watch out for those people, and help us to watch out for those people too. Help us in that process not to get into worldviews and systems that are opposed to your way of thinking, but help us to really have wisdom and love and charity and kindness and insight as we navigate all these difficult issues. Lord, I pray that you would continue to bring forth your truth, that your truth would prevail, that if there's things I said tonight that were incorrect or wrong or misleading, that you would bring that to light and that you would correct that. And Lord, just give us your spirit as we continue to work through these issues. And I just pray that you would build your church here in Hutchinson and that you would receive all the glory. In Jesus' name, amen. You're dismissed.